You gotta call the police, Andy says. They're horrible. Dear Jesus, Morty, they're the most horrible pictures I ever saw. Polaroids. And, oh, man, I thought he was gonna come back in any second. But at first I was just froze, and I slow down, Morty says, concerned. What are you talking about? Andy takes a deep breath and makes a visible effort to get himself under control. Have you seen Potter? He asks. The guy in 314. Nope, Morty says. But most nights he's in Lucky's around this time, having a few beers and maybe a hamburger. Although why anybody would eat anything in that place, I don't know. Then, perhaps associating one Tomaine Palace with another, hey, have you heard what the cops found out at Ed's Eats? Trevor Gordon was by, and he said, never mind. Andy sits in the chair on the other side of the desk and stares at Morty with wet, terrified eyes. Call the police. Do it right now. Tell them that the fisherman is a man named George Potter, and he lives on the third floor of the Nelson Hotel. Andy's face tightens in a hard grimace, then relaxes again. Right down the hall from yours truly. Potter? You're dreaming, Andy. That guy's nothing but a retired builder. Wouldn't hurt a fly. I don't know about flies, but he hurt the hell out of some little kids. I seen the Polaroids he took of them. They're in his closet. They're the worst things you ever saw. Then Andy does something that amazes Morty and convinces him that this isn't a joke, and probably not just a mistake either. Andy rails back, begins to cry. Tansy Freneau, a.k.a. Irma Freneau's grieving mother, is not actually grieving yet. She knows she should be, but grief has been deferred. Right now, she feels as if she is floating in a cloud of warm, bright wool. The doctor, Pam Scarter's associate, Norma Whitestone, gave her 5 milligrams of lorazepam 4 or 5 hours ago, but that's only the start. The holiday trailer park where Tansy and Irma have lived since Cubby Freneau took off for Green Bay in 98 is handy to the sand bar, and she has a part-time thing going with Lester Moon, one of the bartenders. The Thunder Five has dubbed Lester Moon Stinky Cheese for some reason, but Tansy unfailingly calls him Lester, which he appreciates almost as much as the occasional boozy grapple in Tansy's bedroom or out back of the bar, where there's a mattress and a blacklight in the storeroom. Around 5 this evening, Lester ran over with a quart of coffee brandy and 400 milligrams of OxyContin, all considerately crushed and ready for snorting. Tansy has done half a dozen lines already, and she is cruising, looking over old pictures of Irma, and just, you know, cruising. What a pretty baby she was, Tansy thinks, unaware that not far away, a horrified hotel clerk is looking at a very different picture of her pretty baby, a nightmare Polaroid he will never be able to forget. It is a picture Tansy herself will never have to look at, suggesting that perhaps there is a God in heaven. She turns a page, Golden Memories has been stamped on the front of her scrapbook, and here is a picture of Tansy and 4-year-old Irma at the Mississippi Electrics Company picnic, back when Irma was 4 and Mississippi Electrics was still a year away from bankruptcy and everything was more or less all right. In the photo, Irma is waiting with a bunch of other tykes, her laughing face smeared with chocolate ice cream. Looking fixedly at this snapshot, Tansy reaches for her glass of coffee brandy and takes a small sip. And suddenly, from nowhere, or the place from which all our more ominous and unconnected thoughts float out into the light of our regard, she finds herself remembering that stupid Edgar Allan Poe poem they had to memorize in the 9th grade. She hasn't thought of it in years and has no reason to now. But the words of the opening stanza rise effortlessly and perfectly in her mind. Looking at Irma, she recites them aloud, in a toneless, pauseless voice that no doubt would have caused Mrs. Normandy to clutch her stringy white hair and groan. Tansy's recitation doesn't affect us that way. Instead, it gives us a deep and abiding chill. It is like listening to a poetry reading given by a corpse. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. At this precise moment, there comes a soft rapping at the cheap fiberboard door of Tansy Furneaux's Airstream. She looks up, eyes floating, lips pursed and glossed with coffee brandy.
Lesser, is that you?
It might be, she supposes. Not the TV people, at least she hopes not. She wouldn't talk to the TV people, sent them packing. She knows in some deep and sadly cunning part of her mind that they would lull her and comfort her only to make her look stupid in the glare of their lights, the way that the people on the Jerry Springer show always end up looking stupid. No answer. And then it comes again. Tap, tap, tap. "'Tis some visitor," she says, getting up. It's like getting up in a dream. "'Tis some visitor," I murmured, tapping at my chamber door. "'Only this and nothing more." Tap, tap, tap. Not like curled knuckles. It's a thinner sound than that. A sound like a single fingernail. Or a beak. She crosses the room in her haze of drugs and brandy. Bare feet whispering on carpet that was once nubbly and now is balding. The ex-mother. She opens the door onto this foggy summer night and sees nothing, because she's looking too high. Then something on the welcome mat rustles. Something, some black thing, is looking up at her with bright, inquiring eyes. It's a raven. Oh, my God, it's Poe's raven. Come to pay her a visit. Jesus, I'm tripping, Tansy says, and runs her hands through her thin hair.
Jesus, repeats the crow on the welcome mat,
and then chipper as a chickadee.
Gorg.
If asked, Tansy would have said she was too stoned to be frightened. But this is apparently not so, because she gives out a disconcerted little cry and takes a step backward. The crow hops briskly across the door sill and strides onto the faded purple carpet, still looking up at her with its bright eyes. Its feathers glisten with condensed drops of mist. It bops on past her, then pauses to preen and fluff. It looks around as if to ask, "How am I doing, sweetheart?"
"Go away," Tansy says. "I don't know what the fuck you are, or if you're here at all, but gorg,"
the crow insists. Then spreads its wings and fleets across the trailer's living room, a charred fleck burnt off the back of the night. Tansy screams and cringes, instinctively shielding her face, but Gorg doesn't come near her. It alights on the table beside her bottle, there not being any bust of Pallas handy. Tansy thinks, it got disoriented in the fog, that's all. It could even be rabid or have that key lime disease, whatever you call it. I ought to go in the kitchen and get the broom, shoo it out before it shits around. But the kitchen is too far. In her current state, the kitchen seems hundreds of miles away, somewhere in the vicinity of Colorado Springs, and there's probably no crow here at all. Thinking of that goddamn poem has caused her to hallucinate, that's all. That and losing her daughter. For the first time, the pain gets through the haze, and Tansy winces from its cruel and wiry heat. She remembers the little hands that sometimes pressed so tidily against the sides of her neck, the cries in the night summoning her from sleep, the smell of her fresh from the bath.
"Her name was Irma,"
she suddenly shouts at the figment standing so boldly beside the brandy bottle.
"Irma, not fucking Lenore. What kind of stupid name is Lenore? Let's hear you say Irma."
"Irma," the visitor croaks obediently, stunning her to silence. And its eyes, ah, its glittering eyes draw her like the eyes of the ancient mariner in that other poem she was supposed to learn but never did.
"Irma, Irma, Irma, Irma,
stop it!"
She doesn't want to hear it, after all. She was wrong. Her daughter's name out of that alien throat is foul, insupportable. She wants to put her hands over her ears and can't. They're too heavy. Her hands have joined the stove and the refrigerator, miserable, half-busted thing in Colorado Springs. All she can do is look into those glittering black eyes. It preens for her, ruffling its ebony sateen feathers. They make a loathsome little scuttering noise all up and down its back, and she thinks, "Prophet," said I, "thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil." Certainty fills her heart like cold water. "What do you know?" she asks.
Why did you come?
No, croaks the crow, Gorg, nodding its beak briskly up and down. Come.
And does it wink? Good God, does it wink at her?
Who killed her? Tansy Furneaux whispers. Who killed my pretty baby?
The crow's eyes fix her, turn her into a bug on a pin. Slowly, feeling more in a dream than ever, but this is happening. On some level, she understands that perfectly. She crosses to the table. Still the crow watches her. Still the crow draws her on. Night's Plutonian shore, she thinks. Night's Plutonian fucking shore.
Who?
Tell me what you know. The crow looks up at her with its bright black eyes. Its beak opens and closes, revealing a wet, red interior in tiny peaks.
Tansy, it croaks. Gum.
The strength runs out of her legs, and she drops to her knees, biting her tongue and making it bleed. Crimson drops splatter her U of W sweatshirt. Now her face is on a level with the bird's face. She can see one of its wings brushing up and down sensuously on the glass side of the coffee brandy bottle. The smell of Gorg is dust and heaped dead flies and ancient urns of buried spice. Its eyes are shining black portholes, looking into some other world. Hell, perhaps. Or Sheol.
Who? She whispers.
Gorg stretches its black and rustling neck until its black beak is actually in the cup of her ear. It begins to whisper, and eventually Tansy Furneaux begins to nod. The light of sanity has left her eyes. And when will it return? Oh, I think we all know the answer to that one. Can you say nevermore? Chapter 16. 6:45 p.m. French Landing is fogged out, fagged out, and uneasy in its heart. But quiet. The quiet won't last. Once it has started, slippage never stops for long. At Maxton's, Chipper has stayed late. And considering the leisurely and really quite sensational blowjob being administered to him by Rebecca Vilas as he sits sprawled in his office chair, his decision to put in a little overtime isn't that surprising. In the common room, the old folks sit transfixed by Julie Andrews and the sound of music. Alice Weathers is actually crying with happiness. Music is her all-time favorite movie. Singing in the Rain comes close, but close never won the cigar. Among those MEC inmates who are ambulatory, only Bernie is missing. Except no one here misses him at all. Bernie is deep in sleep. The spirit that now controls him, the demon, we might as well say, has its own agenda in French Landing, and it has used Bernie roughly over these last few weeks. Not that Bernie's complaining, he is a very willing accomplice. On Norway Valley Road, Jack Sawyer is just pulling his Dodge Ram into Henry Layden's driveway. The fog out here is thinner, but it still turns the truck's headlamps into soft coronas. Tonight he will recommence Bleak House at Chapter 7, The Ghost's Walk, and hopefully reach the end of Chapter 8, covering a multitude of sins. But before Dickens, he has promised to listen to the Wisconsin Rat's latest candidate for hot rotation, a number called Gimme Back My Dog by Slobberbone. Every 5 years or so, another great rock and roll song comes breakdancing out of the woodwork, Henry has told him over the phone, and Jack's damned if he can't hear the rat screaming around the edges of his friend's voice, popping wheelies out there on the edge of darkness. This is a great rock and roll song. If you say so, Jack replies dubiously. His idea of a great rock and roll song is Run Around Sue by Dion. At 16 Robin Hood Lane, that sweet little Cape Cod honey of a home, Fred Marshall is down on his hands and knees, wearing a pair of green rubber gloves and washing the floor. He's still got Tyler's baseball cap balanced on his head, and he's weeping. Out at the Holiday Trailer Park, the crow Gorg is dripping poison into the porches of Tansy Furneaux's ears.
In the sturdy brick house on Herman Street, where he lives with the beautiful Sarah and the equally beautiful David, Dale Gilbertson is just getting ready to head back to the office, his movements slightly slowed by two helpings of chicken pot pie and a dish of bread pudding. When the telephone rings, he is not terribly surprised. He's had that feeling after all. His caller is Debbie Anderson, and from her first word, he knows that something has popped. He listens, nodding, asking an occasional question. His wife stands in the kitchen doorway, watching him with worried eyes. Dale bends and jots on the pad beside the phone. Sarah walks over and reads two names, Andy Railsback and M. Fine. "You still got Railsback on the line?" he asks. "Yes, on hold. Patch me in."
"Dale, I don't know if I know how to do that."
Debbie sounds uncharacteristically flustered. Dale closes his eyes a moment, reminds himself that this isn't her usual job. "Ernie's not there yet?"
"No."
"Who is?"
"Bobby Duloc. I think Dit might be in the shower."
"Put Bobby on," Dale says, and is relieved when Bobby is able to patch him quickly and painlessly through to Andy Railsback in Morty Fine's office. The two men have been upstairs to room 314, and one look at the Polaroid scattered on the floor of George Potter's closet has been enough for Morty. He's now as pale as Andy himself, maybe paler. Outside the police station, Ernie Terrio and Reginald Doc Amberson meet in the parking lot. Doc has just arrived on his old but perfectly maintained Harley Fat Boy. They exchange amiable greetings in the fog. Ernie Terrio is another cop, sort of, but relax, he's the last one we'll have to meet. Well, there is an FBI agent running around here someplace, but never mind him right now. He's in Madison and he's a fool. Ernie is a trim 65, retired from full-time police duty for almost 12 years, and still four times the cop Arnold Hrabowski will ever be. He supplements his pension by doing night dispatch at the FLPD, he doesn't sleep so well these days thanks to a cranky prostate, and pulling private security time at First Bank of Wisconsin on Fridays, when the Wells Fargo people come at 2 and the Brinks people at 4. Doc looks every inch the Hell's Angel with his long black and gray beard, which he sometimes braids with ribbons in the style of the pirate Edward Teach, and he brews beer for a living. But the two men get along very well. For one thing, they recognize each other's intelligence. Ernie doesn't know if Doc really is a doctor, but he could be. Maybe at one point he was. "Anything changed?" Doc asks.
"Not that I know of, my friend," Ernie says.
One of the five comes by every night in turn to check. Tonight, Doc's got the duty. "Mind if I walk in with you?"
"Nope," Ernie said. "Just as long as you respect the rule."
Doc nods. Some of the other fives can be pissy about the rule, especially Sonny, who's pissy about lots of stuff. But Doc abides by it. One cup of coffee or 5 minutes, whichever comes first, then down the road you go. Ernie, who saw plenty of real Hell's Angels when he was a cop in Phoenix back in the 70s, appreciates how deeply patient Beezer St. Pierre and his crew have been. But of course, they are not Hell's Angels, or pagans, or beasts on bikes, or any of that nonsense. Ernie doesn't know exactly what they are, but he knows that they listen to Beezer, and he suspects that Beezer's patience is growing thin. Ernie knows his would be by now. "Well then, come on in," Ernie says, clapping the big man on the shoulder. "Let's see what's shaking." Quite a lot, as it turns out. Dale finds he is able to think quickly and clearly. His earlier fear has left him, partly because the fuck-up has already happened, and the case, the official case anyway, has been taken away from him. Mostly because he knows he can now call on Jack if he needs to, and Jack will answer. Jack's his safety net. He listens to Railsback's description of the Polaroids, mostly letting the old fellow vent and settle a bit, and then asks a single question about the two photos of the boy.
"Yellow," Railsback replies with no hesitation. "The shirt was yellow. I could read the word Kiwanis on it. Nothing else. The blood."
Dale says he understands, and tells Railsback an officer will join them shortly. There is the sound of the phone shifting hands, and then Fine is in his ear, a fellow Dale knows and doesn't much care for.
"What if he comes back, Chief? What if Potter comes back here to the hotel?"
"Can you see the lobby from where you are?"
"No," petulant. "We're in the office, I told you that." Then go out front. Look busy. If he comes in, I don't want to do that. If you'd seen those pictures, you wouldn't want to do it either.
You don't have to say boo to him, Dale says. Just call if he goes by.
But
hang up the telephone, sir. I've got a lot to do. Sarah has put her hand on her husband's shoulder. Dale puts his free one over hers. There is a click in his ear loud enough to sound disgruntled.
Bobby, are you on?
Right here, Chief. Debbie, too, and Dit. Oh, and Ernie just walked in.
He lowers his voice. He's got one of those motorcycle boys with him, the one who calls himself Doc.
Dale thinks furiously. Ernie, Debbie, Dit, and Bobby, all in uniform. Not good for what he wants. He comes to a sudden decision and says,
put the hogger on.
What?
You heard me.
A moment later, he's talking to Doc Amberson. You want to help bust the fucker who killed Armand St. Pierre's little girl?
Hell yes, no hesitation.
All right, don't ask questions and don't make me repeat myself.
I'm listening, Doc says crisply.
Tell Officer Dulac to give you the blue cell phone in evidence storage. The one we took off the doper who skipped. He'll know the one I mean.
If anyone tries to *69 a call originating from that phone, Dale knows, they won't be able to trace it back to his shop, and that's just as well. He is, after all, supposed to be off the case.
Blue cell phone.
Then walk down to Lucky's Tavern, next to the Nelson Hotel.
I got my bike.
No, walk.
Go inside, buy a lottery ticket. You'll be looking for a tall man, skinny, salt-and-pepper hair, about 70, khaki pants, maybe a khaki shirt, too. Most likely alone. His favorite roost is between the jukebox and the little hall that goes to the John's. If he's there, call the station. Just hit 911. Got all that?
Yeah.
Go.
Really shuck your buns, Doctor.
Doc doesn't even bother to say goodbye. A moment later, Bobby's back on the phone.
What are we going to do, Dale?
If he's there, we're going to take the son of a bitch, Dale says.
He's still under control, but he can feel his heartbeat accelerating, really starting to crank.
The world stands out before him with a brilliance that hasn't been there since the first murder. He can feel every finger of his wife's hand on his shoulder. He can smell her makeup and her hairspray.
Get Tom Lund and lay out three of the Kevlar vests.
He thinks that over, then says,
make it four.
You're going to call Hollywood?
Yeah, he says, but we're not going to wait for him.
On that, he hangs up. Because he wants to bolt, he makes himself stand still for a moment, takes a deep breath, lets it out, then takes another.
Sarah grasps his hands. Be careful.
Oh, yeah, Dale says. You can take that to the bank.
He starts for the door.
What about Jack? She calls.
I'll get him from the car, he says, without slowing. If God's on our side, we'll have the guy in lockup before he makes it halfway to the station.
5 minutes later, Doc is standing at the bar in Lucky's, listening to Trace Adkins sing I Left Something Turned On at Home, and scratching a Wisconsin instant winner ticket. It actually is a winner, $10, but most of Doc's attention is focused in the direction of the juke. He bops his shaggy head a little bit, as if he's really getting off on this particular example of shit-kicker deluxe. Sitting at the table in the corner with a plate of spaghetti in front of him, the sauce as red as a nosebleed, and a pitcher of beer close at hand, is the man he's looking for. Tall, even sitting down, skinny, lines grooving his tanned hound dog's face, salt-and-pepper hair neatly combed back. Doc can't really see the shirt because the guy's got a napkin tucked into the collar, but the long legs sticking out from under the table is dressed in khaki. If Doc was entirely sure this was the baby-killing puke who did Amy, he'd make a citizen's arrest right now. An extremely rough one. Fuck the cops and their Miranda shit. But maybe the guy's only a witness or an accomplice or something. He takes his 10-spot from the bartender, turns down the suggestion that he stay for a beer, and strolls back out into the fog. 10 steps up the hill, he takes the blue cell phone from his pocket and dials 911. This time it's Debbie who answers.
He's there, Doc says. What next?
Bring the phone back, she says, and hangs up.
Well, fuck you very much, Doc says mildly. But he'll be a good boy. He'll play by their rules. Only first.
He dials another number on the blue phone, which has one more chore to do before it passes out of our tail forever, and Bear Girl answers.
Put him on, sweetness, he says, hoping she won't tell him that Beezer's gone down to the sandbar.
If the Bees ever goes down there alone, it'll be because he's after one thing, a bad thing. But a moment later, Beezer's voice is in his ear, rough, as if he's been crying.
Yeah, what?
Round him up and get your heavy-set ass down to the police station parking lot, Doc tells him. I'm not 100% certain, but I think they might be getting ready to nail the motherfucker done it. I might even have seen Beezer is gone before Doc can get the phone off his ear and push the off button. He stands in the fog, looking up at the bleary lights of the French Landing cop shop, wondering why he didn't tell Beezer and the boys to meet him outside of Lucky's. He supposes he knows the answer. If Beezer got to that old guy before the cops, spaghetti might turn out to be the old guy's last meal. Better to wait, maybe. Wait and see. There's nothing but a fine mist on Herman Street, but the soup thickens almost as soon as Dale turns toward downtown. He turns on his parking lights, but they're not enough. He goes to low beams, then calls Jax. He hears the recorded announcement start, kills the call, and dials Uncle Henry's. And Uncle Henry answers. In the background, Dale can hear a howling, fuzz-toned guitar and someone growling, "Give me back my dog," over and over. "Yes, he's just arrived," Henry allows. "We're currently in the musical appreciation phase of our evening, literature to follow. We've reached a critical juncture in Bleak House, Chesney Wald, The Ghost's Walk, Mrs. Rouncewell, all of that. And so unless your need is actually urgent, it is. Put him on now, Unc." Henry sighs. "Oui, mon capitaine." A moment later, he's talking to Jack, who of course agrees to come at once. This is good, but French Landing's police chief finds some of his friend's reactions a trifle puzzling. No, Jack doesn't want Dale to hold the arrest until he arrives. Very considerate of him to ask, also very considerate of Dale to have saved him a Kevlar vest, part of the law enforcement booty showered on the FLPD and thousands of other small police departments during the Reagan years. But Jack believes Dale and his men can nab George Potter without much trouble. The truth is, Jack Sawyer seems only slightly interested in George Potter. Ditto the horrific photos, although they must certainly be authentic, rails back as ID Johnny Erkenham's yellow Kiwanis Little League shirt, a detail never given to the press. Even the loathsome Wendell Green never ferreted out that particular fact. What Jack asks about, not once but several times, is the guy Andy Railsback saw in the hallway. "Blue robe, one slipper, and that's all I know," Dale is finally forced to admit. "Jesus, Jack, what does it matter? Listen, I have to get off the telephone." "Ding dong," Jack replies, equably enough, and rings off. Dale turns into the foggy parking lot. He sees Ernie Terrio and the biker brewer called Doc standing outside the back door talking. They are little more than shadows in the drifting fog. Dale's conversation with Jack has left him feeling very uneasy, as if there are huge clues and signposts that he, dullard that he is, has entirely missed. But what clues? For Christ's sake, what signposts? And now a dash of resentment flavors his unease. Perhaps a high-powered Lucas Davenport type like Jack Sawyer just can't believe in the obvious. Perhaps guys like him are always more interested in the dog that doesn't bark. Sound travels well in the fog, and halfway to the station's back door, Dale hears motorcycle engines explode into life down by the river, down on Nail House Row. "Dale," Ernie says. He nods a greeting as if this were any ordinary evening. "Hey, Chief," Doc chips in. He's smoking an unfiltered cigarette and looks to Dale like a Pall Mall or a Chesterfield. Some doctor, Dale thinks. "If I may egregiously misquote Mr. Rogers," Doc goes on, "it's a beautiful night in the neighborhood, wouldn't you say?" "You called them," Dale says, jerking his head in the direction of the revving motorcycles. Two pairs of headlights swing into the parking lot. Dale sees Tom Lund behind the wheel of the first car. The second vehicle is almost certainly Danny Cheetah's personal. The troops are gathering once more. Hopefully this time they can avoid any cataclysmic fuck-ups. They better. This time they could be playing for all the marbles. "Well, I couldn't comment on that directly," Doc says, "but I could ask if they were your friends, what would you do?" "Same damn thing," Dale says, and goes inside. Henry Layden once more sits primly in the passenger seat of the Ram pickup. Tonight he's dressed in an open-collared white shirt and a pair of trim blue khakis.
slim as a male model, silvering hair combed back. Did Sidney Carton look any cooler going to the guillotine, even in Charles Dickens's mind? Jack doubts it. "Henry, I know," Henry says. "Sit here in the truck like a good little boy until I'm called." "With the doors locked. And don't say we, mon capitaine. That one's wore out." "Will affirmative do?" "Nicely." The fog thickens as they near town, and Jack dips his headlights. High beams are no good in this shit. He looks at the dashboard clock, 7:03 p.m. Things are speeding up. He's glad. Do more, think less. Jack Sawyer's recipe for easy care sanity. "I'll whisk you inside as soon as they've got Potter jugged." "You don't expect them to have a problem with that, do you?" "No," Jack says, then changes the subject. "You know, you surprised me with that Slobberbone record. He can't really call it a song, not when the lead vocalist simply shrieked most of the lyrics at the top of his lungs. That was good." "It's the lead guitar that makes the record," Henry says, picking up on Jack's careful use of the word. "Surprisingly sophisticated. Usually the best you can hope for is in tune." He unrolls his window, sticks his head out like a dog, then pulls it back in. Speaking in that same conversational voice, he says, "The whole town reeks." "It's the fog. It pulls up the river's stinkiest essence." "No," Henry replies, matter-of-factly, "it's death. I smell it, and I think you do, too. Only maybe not with your nose." "I smell it," Jack admits. "Potter's the wrong man." "I think so." "The man Railsback saw was a Judas goat." "The man Railsback saw was almost certainly the fisherman." They drive in silence for a while. "Henry?"
"Affirmative."
"What's the best record? The best record and the best song?" Henry thinks about it. "Do you realize what a dreadfully personal question that is?"
"Yes."
Henry thinks some more, then says, "Stardust, maybe. Hoagie Carmichael. For you?" The man behind the wheel thinks back, all the way back to when Jackie was 6. His father and Uncle Morgan had been the jazz fiends. His mother had had simpler tastes. He remembers her playing the same song over and over one endless L.A. summer, sitting and looking out the window and smoking. "Who is that lady, Mom?" Jackie asks. And his mother says, "Patsy Cline. She died in an airplane crash." "Crazy Arms," Jack says, "the Patsy Cline version, written by Ralph Mooney and Chuck Seals. That's the best record. That's the best song." Henry says no more for the rest of the drive. Jack is crying. Henry can smell his tears. "Let us now take the wider view," as some politician or other no doubt said. "We almost have to, because things have begun to overlap. While Beezer and the rest of the Thunder Five are arriving in the FLPD parking lot just off Sumner Street, Dale and Tom Lund and Bobby Dulac, bulky in their Kevlar vests, are double parking in front of Lucky's. They park in the street because Dale wants plenty of room to swing the back door of the cruiser wide so that Potter can be bundled in as fast as possible. Next door, Dit Jesperson and Danny Cheetah are at the Nelson Hotel, where they will cordon off room 314 with yellow police line tape. Once that's done, their orders are to bring Andy Railsback and Morty Fine to the police station. Inside the police station, Ernie Terrio is calling WSP officers Brown and Black, who will arrive after the fact, and if they're pissed about that, good deal. At the sandbar, a dead-eyed Tansy Freneau has just pulled the plug on the jukebox, killing the wallflowers.
"Listen to me, everybody!" she cries in a voice that's not her own. "They've got him. They've got the baby-murdering son of a bitch. His name's Potter. They'll have him up in Madison by midnight, and unless we do something, some smart lawyer will have him back out on the street by next Monday. Who wants to help me do something about it?"
There is a moment of silence, and then a roar. The half-stoned, half-drunk habitués of the sandbar know exactly what they want to do about it. Jack and Henry, meanwhile, with no fog to slow them down until they hit town, swing into the police station parking lot just behind the Thunder Five, who park in a line around Doc's Fat Boy. The lot is filling up rapidly, mostly with cops' personal vehicles.
Word of the impending arrest has spread like fire in dry grass. Inside, one of Dale's crew, we need not bother with exactly which one, spots the blue cell phone Doc used outside Lucky's. This cop grabs it and ducks into the closet-sized room marked evidence storage. At the Oak Tree Inn, where he is checked in for the duration of the fisherman case, Wendell Green is getting sullenly drunk. In spite of 3 double whiskeys, his neck still aches from having his camera pulled off by the biker asshole, and his gut still aches from being sucker-punched by the Hollywood asshole. The parts of him that hurt most of all, however, are his pride and his pocketbook. Sawyer concealed evidence just as sure as shit sticks to a blanket. Wendell is halfway to believing that Sawyer himself is the fisherman, but how can he prove either thing with his film gone? When the bartender says he has a call, Wendell almost tells him to stick the call up his ass. But he's a professional, goddammit, a professional news hawk. And so he goes over to the bar and takes the phone. "Green," he growls. "Hello, asshole," says the cop with the blue cell phone. Wendell doesn't yet know his caller is a cop, only that it's some cheery ghoul poaching on his valuable drinking time. "You want to print some good news for a change?" "Good news doesn't sell papers, my pal." "This will. We caught the guy." "What?" In spite of the 3 doubles, Wendell Green is suddenly the most undrunk man on the planet. "Did I stutter?" The caller is positively gloating, but Wendell Green no longer cares. "We caught the fisherman. Not the Stadies, not the Phoebes, us. Name's George Potter, early 70s, retired builder, had Polaroids of all 3 dead kids. If you hustle, you can maybe be here to snap the picture when Dale takes him inside." This thought, this shining possibility, explodes in Wendell Green's head like a firework. Such a photo could be worth 5 times as much as one of Little Irma's corpse, because the reputable mags would want it. And TV. Also, think of this. What if someone shot the bastard as Marshal Dillon was taking him in? Given the town's mood, it's far from impossible. Wendell has a brief and brilliant memory of Lee Harvey Oswald clutching his stomach, mouth open in his dying yawp. "Who is this?" he blurts. "Officer fucking Friendly," the voice on the other end says, and clicks off. In Lucky's Tavern, Patty Lovelace is now informing those assembled, older than the sandbar crowd and a good deal less interested in non-alcoholic substances, that she can't get no satisfaction and her tractor can't get no traction. George Potter has finished his spaghetti, neatly folded his napkin, which in the end had to catch only a single drop of red sauce, and turned seriously to his beer. Sitting close to the juke as he is, he doesn't notice that the room has quieted with the entrance of 3 men, only one in uniform but all 3 armed, and wearing what looked too much like bulletproof vests to be anything else. "George Potter," someone says, and George looks up. With his glass in one hand and his pitcher of suds in the other, he is a sitting duck. "Yeah, what about it?" he asks, and then he is snatched by the arms and shoulders and yanked from his spot. His knees connect with the bottom of the table, overturning it. The spaghetti plate and the pitcher hit the floor. The plate shatters. The pitcher, made of sterner stuff, does not. A woman screams. A man says, "Yow," in a low and respectful voice. Potter holds on to his partly filled glass for a moment, and then Tom Lund plucks this potential weapon from his hand. A second later, Dale Gilbertson is snapping on the cuffs, and Dale has time to think that it's the most satisfying sound he's ever heard in his life. His tractor has finally gotten some traction, by God. This deal is light years from the snafu at Ed's. This is slick and tidy. Less than 10 seconds after Dale asked the only question, "George Potter?" the suspect is out the door and into the fog. Tom has one elbow, Bobby the other. Dale is still rattling off the Miranda warning, sounding like an auctioneer on amphetamines, and George Potter's feet never touch the sidewalk. Jack Sawyer is fully alive for the first time since he was 12 years old, riding back from California in a Lincoln limousine driven by a werewolf. He has an idea that later on he will pay a high price for this regained vividness. but he hopes he will just button his lip and fork over when the time comes, because the rest of his adult life now seems so gray. He stands outside his truck, looking in the window at Henry. The air is dank and already charged with excitement. He can hear the blue-white parking lot lights sizzling like something frying in hot juices. Henry.
Affirmative.
Do you know the hymn Amazing Grace?
Of course I do. Everyone knows Amazing Grace.
Jack says, Was blind, but now I see. I understand that now. Henry turns his blind, fearfully intelligent face toward Jack. He is smiling. It is the second sweetest smile Jack has ever seen. The blue ribbon still goes to Wolf, that dear friend of his wandering 12th autumn. Good old Wolf, who liked everything right here and now.
You're back, aren't you?
Standing in the parking lot, our old friend grins. Jack's back. That's affirmative.
Then go do what you came back to do, Henry says.
I want you to roll up the windows.
And not be able to hear?
I think not, Henry tells him pleasantly enough. More cops are coming, and this time the blue lights of the lead car are flashing and the siren is blurping. Jack detects a celebratory note to those little blurps and decides he doesn't have time to stand here arguing with Henry about the Ram's windows. He heads for the back door of the police station, and two of the blue-white arcs cast his shadow double on the fog, one dark head north and one south. Part-time officers Holtz and Nestler pull in behind the car bearing Gilbertson, Lund, Dulac, and Potter. We don't care much about Holtz and Nestler. Next in line is Jesperson and Cheetah, with Railsback and Morton Fine in the back seat. Morty is complaining about the lack of knee room. We care about Railsback, but he can wait. Next into the lot, oh, this is interesting, if not entirely unexpected, Wendell Green's beat-up red Toyota, with the man himself behind the wheel. Around his neck is his backup camera, a Minolta that'll keep taking pictures as long as Wendell keeps pressing the button. No one from the sandbar, not yet, but there is one more car waiting to turn into the already crowded lot. It's a discreet green Saab, with a police power sticker on the left side of the bumper and one reading Hugs Not Drugs on the right. Behind the wheel of the Saab, looking stunned but determined to do the right thing, whatever the right thing might be, is Arnold the Mad Hungarian Hrabowski. Standing in a line against the brick wall of the police station are the Thunder Five. They wear identical denim vests with gold fives on the left breast. Five sets of meaty arms are crossed on five broad chests. Doc, Kaiser Bill, and Sonny wear their hair in thick ponytails. Mouse's is Corn Road tonight. And Beezer's floods down over his shoulders, making him look to Jack a little like Bob Seger in his prime. Earrings twinkle, tats flex on huge biceps. Armand St. Pierre, Jack says to the one closest the door. Jack Sawyer. From Ed's? He holds out his hand and isn't exactly surprised when Beezer only looks at it. Jack smiles pleasantly. You helped big time out there.
Thanks.
Nothing from the bees.
Is there going to be trouble with the intake of the prisoner, do you think?
Jack asks. He might be asking if Beezer thinks it will shower after midnight. Beezer watches over Jack's shoulder as Dale, Bobby, and Tom help George Potter from the back of the cruiser and begin walking him briskly toward the back door. Wendell Green raises his camera, then is nearly knocked off his feet by Danny Cheetah, who doesn't even have the pleasure of seeing which asshole he's bumped.
Watch it, dickweed, Wendell squawks.
Beezer, meanwhile, favors Jack, if that is the word, with a brief, cold glance.
Well now, he says, we'll have to see how it shakes out, won't we?
Indeed we will, Jack agrees. He sounds almost happy. He pushes in between Mouse and Kaiser Bill, making himself a place. The Thunder Five plus one. And perhaps because they sense he doesn't fear them, the two wide boys make room. Jack crosses his own arms over his chest. If he had a vest, an earring, and a tattoo, he really would fit right in.
The prisoner and his custodians kill the distance between the car and the building quickly. Just before they reach it, Beezer St. Pierre, spiritual leader of the Thunder Five and father of Amy, whose liver and tongue were eaten, steps in front of the door. His arms are still folded. In the heartless glare of the parking lot lights, his massive biceps are blue. Bobby and Tom suddenly look like guys with a moderate case of the flu. Dale looks stony, and Jack continues to smile gently, arms placidly crossed, seeming to gaze everywhere and nowhere at once.
"Get out of the way, Beezer," Dale says. "I want to book this man."
And what of George Potter? Is he stunned, resigned, both? It's hard to tell. But when Beezer's bloodshot blue eyes meet Potter's brown ones, Potter does not drop his gaze. Behind him, the looky-loos in the parking lot fall silent. Standing between Danny Cheetah and Dit Jesperson, Andy Railsback and Morty Fine are gawking. Wendell Green raises his camera and then holds his breath like a sniper who's lucked into a shot, just one, mind you, of the commanding general.
"Did you kill my daughter?" Beezer asks. The gentle inquiry is somehow more terrible than any raw yell could have been, and the world seems to hold its breath. Dale makes no move. In that moment, he seems as frozen as the rest of them. The world waits, and the only sound is a low, mournful hoot from some fog-bound boat on the river.
"Sir, I never killed no one," Potter says. He speaks softly and without emphasis. Although he has expected nothing else, the words still box Jack's heart. There is an unexpected, painful dignity in them. It's as if George Potter is speaking for all the lost good men of the world.
"Stand aside, Beezer," Jack says gently. "You don't want to hurt this guy." And Beezer, looking suddenly not at all sure of himself, does stand aside. Before Dale can get his prisoner moving again, a raucously cheerful voice, it can only be Wendell's, yells out,
Hey, fisherman, smile for the camera!"
They all look around, not just Potter. They have to. That cry is as insistent as fingernails dragged slowly down a slate blackboard. White light strobes the foggy parking lot. 1, 2, 3, 4, and Dale snarls,
"Ah, fuck me till I cry. Come on, you guys. Jack, I want you."
From behind them, one of the other cops calls,
"Dale, you want me to grab this creep?"
"Leave him alone," Dale shouts and bowls his way inside. It's not until the door is closed behind him and he's in the lower hall with Jack, Tom, and Bobby that Dale realizes how certain he was that Beezer would simply snatch the old man away from him and then crack his neck like a chicken bone.
"Dale?"
Debbie Anderson calls uncertainly from halfway down the stairs.
"Is everything all right?"
Dale looks at Jack, who still has his arms crossed over his chest and is still smiling his little smile.
"I think it is," Dale says, "for now."
20 minutes later, Jack and Henry, the latter gentleman retrieved from the truck and still reet petite, sit in Dale's office. Beyond the closed door, the ready room roars with conversation and laughter. Almost every cop on the FLPD force is out there, and it sounds like a goddamn New Year's Eve party. There are occasional shouts and smacking sounds that can only be relieved boys and girls in blue high-fiving each other. In a little while, Dale will put a stop to that shit, but for now he's content to let them go ahead. He understands how they feel, even though he no longer feels that way himself. George Potter has been printed and stuck in a cell upstairs to think things over. Brown and Black of the state police are on their way. For now, that is enough. As for Triumph, well, something about his friend's smile and his faraway eyes have put Triumph on hold.
"I didn't think you were going to give Beezer his moment," Jack says.
"It's a good thing you did. There might have been trouble right here in River City if you'd tried to face him down."
"I suppose I have a better idea tonight of how he feels," Dale replies. "I lost track of my own kid tonight, and it scared the living shit out of me."
"David?" Henry cries, leaning forward. "Is David okay?"
"Yeah, Uncle Henry, Dave's fine."
Dale returns his gaze to the man who now lives in his father's house. He's remembering the first time Jack ever laid eyes on Thornburg Kinderling. Dale had at that point known Jack only 9 days, long enough to form some favorable opinions, but not long enough to realize how really extraordinary Jack Sawyer was. That was the day Jenna Massengale at the taproom told Jack about the trick Kinderling did when he was getting squiffy. That little trick of pinching his nostrils shut with his palm turned out to the world. They had just arrived back at the police station from interviewing Jenna, Dale in his personal unit that day, and he'd touched Jack on the shoulder just as Jack was about to get out of the car. "Speak a name, see the face it belongs to before supper time. That's what my mother used to say." He pointed down to 2nd Street, where a broad-shouldered, bald fellow had just come out of News and Notions, a newspaper under his arm and a fresh deck of smokes in his hand. "That's Thornburg Kinderling, his very own self." Jack had bent forward without speaking, looking with the sharpest and perhaps the most merciless eyes Dale had ever seen in his life. "Do you want to approach him?" Dale had asked. "No, hush." And Jack simply sat with one leg in Dale's car and one out of it, not moving, eyes narrowed. So far as Dale could tell, he didn't even breathe. Jack watched Kinderling open his cigarettes, tap one out, put it in his mouth, and light it. He watched Kinderling glance at the headline of the Herald and then saunter to his own car, an all-wheel drive Subaru. Watched him get in, watched him drive away. And by that time, Dale realized he was holding his own breath. "Well," he'd asked when the Kinderling-mobile was gone, "what do you think?" And Jack had said, "I think he's the guy." Only Dale had known better. Even then, he had known better. Jack was saying, "I think," only because he and Chief Dale Gilbertson of French Landing, Wisconsin, were still on short terms, getting to know you, getting to work with you terms. What he had meant was, "I know." And although that was impossible, Dale had quite believed him. Now, sitting in his office with Jack directly across the desk from him, his reluctant but scarily gifted deputy, Dale asks, "What do you think? Did he do it?" "Come on, Dale, how can I—" "Don't waste my time, Jack, because those assholes from WSP are going to be here any minute, and they'll take Potter hi-ho over the hills. You knew it was Kinderling the second you looked at him, and you were halfway down the block. You were close enough to Potter when I brought him in to count the hairs in his nose. So what do you think?" Jack is quick, at least, spares him the suspense and just administers the chop. "No," he says, "not Potter. Potter's not the fisherman.